Welcome back to the Motherlode Show, everybody. I'm Jackson Dunn here with you for another week. I'm glad to be bringing you the Motherlode Show, and this week I'm going to be talking about one of the most famous, it isn't as talked about today, but it was one of the most famous debates over whether religion should be not only part of the government, but also be included in the scientific debate. We all know how the effects have affected us today, but we don't really know what this trial is all about. And for a trial that was so wildly popular, so wildly controversial at its time, it's amazing that we don't really have a whole lot of knowledge on it. And for that reason, I want to talk about it here on the podcast today. So the Scopes trial is the trial that I'm talking about, the Scopes monkey trial. It was also known as the State of Tennessee versus John Thomas Scopes. Now, John Thomas Scopes was a teacher. And the reason why it's famously called the Scopes monkey trial is because he was one of the first teachers to teach the theory of evolution. Now, the theory of evolution at the time was a very, very widely spread theory, but not widely accepted in the scientific community. There were certainly a couple of people who really talked about it a lot. And actually, if you read back to certain books, such as Jules Verne's 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, you actually see that there were some scientists who kind of took it slightly credibly, at least. And the interesting thing about the Scopes monkey trial was that it was the first time where it was really talked about in terms of whether or not it should be taught as a real theory. Now, there were very many famous scientists who kind of chose a side in the Scopes monkey trial, who either chose, you know what, it makes a lot of sense for us to put our names behind this new theory. A lot of other people who said, no, it's absolutely ridiculous on the face of it. And just like political debates of today, especially ones that have to do with religion or morality, it was one of those topics that was fought over for a long time. What's very funny about this trial was that John Thomas Scopes, the teacher in the case, who was found guilty of going against the law in Tennessee that said that you couldn't teach evolution in school. He actually didn't really know that he had taught evolution. He was teaching what he thought was popular science of the time. His prejudice lay, if you will, in sympathy for this new idea of evolution. The other person, the person on the other side of this case was Bishop Samuel Wilberforce, who was a very famous orator in the early 1920s, certainly a Christian fundamentalist, and very much against the idea of evolution. Now, during his time, to be fair, he was against it from a scientific perspective, not only a religious perspective, because the evidence for evolution, at least the evidence that was presented by the scientific community, was very little and was perpetrated with tons of hoaxes with people who were really trying to, had an axe to grind, were really trying to push the idea of evolution despite the lack of evidence for it, and were willing to go to great and unethical lengths to prove their idea. One of these guys was Charles Dawson. He is believed to be the perpetrator of one of the biggest hoaxes in the creation versus evolution debate, the Piltdown Man. Now, the Piltdown Man was a skeleton that was found, a skull rather, that was found in around 1915. It was believed to be, and it was from Piltdown, England, that's where the name came from, it was believed to be one of the first evidences of the missing link between men and monkeys and the evolution between them. Now, fast forward years later, it was realized that it was a hoax, that whoever had put it together was very good at what they did, so it fooled people for a long time, but had put together things like teeth from pigs and had put together parts of monkey skulls and parts of human skulls to try to make this hybrid monkey-human that fooled scientists, especially because there wasn't DNA testing and other things like there is today. Dawson never really owned up to making a hoax of this. He was its original discoverer. He never owned up to making a hoax of this, and unfortunately he died before it was really disproven. But it was an obvious fakery, and for this reason, people like Bishop Samuel Wilberforce, who were Christian fundamentalists and who were looking at the evidence of the day, were very skeptical, looked askance at the people who tried to say that evolution was a credible theory. Now, to go back to what we were talking about before, John Thomas Scopes, the school teacher, didn't really think or didn't even really know that he was teaching evolution. He supposedly incriminated himself on purpose just so that this would go to trial. And while he did lose the trial, he was convicted of defying the state's law to teach evolution in school. His lawyer, the very famous Clarence Darrow, and the people behind him publicized the trial to such an extent that the laws were eventually changed and the theory of evolution was allowed as a credible theory within the scientific community. Now, there's a lot of debate over whether or not that was a good idea. And over time, the theory of evolution has basically won out over the previous theory that was taught in schools, the idea that God created the earth using his voice, basically the biblical story of creation. Over time, this has really died in the scientific community as a more objective standard has been worked on by scientists. They've been trying to find the subjective standard that doesn't have to have something supernatural. Because, of course, if you're trying to figure out the very basic ideas of life and the universe, that's what you want to do. You want to take it to its elements. You want to take it to where you can reason out every little thing. The problem that creationists note, and actually the problem that evolutionists note, although in many cases, unfortunately, it's really stuck under the rug or put on the back burner, hidden from the public discussion, is the fact that there is so much in science that cannot be explained. That when you have a very one-dimensional theory, a theory of the Big Bang, and then the classic traditional idea of evolution that we, you know, that animals became more and more complex over time as they evolved to adapt to their surroundings, right? This idea is very one-dimensional, and it continues to shift over time as new discoveries come out. For instance, back in the day of John Thomas Scopes, the idea was that animals that looked similar were obviously similar. So monkeys and humans, similar. Birds and fish that have similar skeleton shapes were related to each other, and obviously one had evolved from the other. And this was the way that it was looked at. Nowadays, when you look at it, this theory has been largely disproven for the reason in the secular scientific community that a fish and a bird don't necessarily, just because they look similar, have similar DNA. And now that we understand the fact that DNA is how genetic information is passed from mother to child or from parents to children, once we have that idea, the whole idea of monkeys to men really shifts, because it doesn't matter as much how things look as how they function. However, creation scientists have a different argument, and they say this: look, mathematically, it's almost impossible for an animal to become more complex over time. We can see this in thermodynamic laws, the laws, of course, that were famous from Isaac Newton and others, that things will generally decay over time. So if you have something that's sitting up on a shelf and you hit it, it's not going to fall upward, it's going to fall downwards, because downwards is a state of lower energy. It takes less energy to fall than it does to go upward, so it will always follow the path of less energy. This is normally followed in biology too, and for this reason, it doesn't seem to make a whole lot of sense to say that things will evolve upwards over time. With that said, I want to go back a little bit and talk about the history of the Scopes monkey trial. And I want to talk about it on terms of a public policy as well, because it was one of the biggest public policy shifts in the American mind. Because back before the Scopes monkey trial, the idea of religion, while it wasn't enforced certainly by the government, while it wasn't something that was pushed by the government, there were some basic ideas, some basic core principles, if you will. Things like the very basics of science. And those things people didn't think they would change, right? And as soon as this new theory came in that basically explained away the presence of God in life, while religion wasn't pushed more or less by the government, the idea of a new atheism, the fact that not only should the government be separated from religion, but teach actively against it, became a thing. Now, an atheist, to be fair, would say that, no, we're not trying to teach against religion by teaching the theory of evolution. You know, if you believe that the earth happened this way, it doesn't really fit science. But the fact is, the way that this trial went off, while it should have honestly been a discussion over whether or not people really evolved from monkeys, from apes, what it actually devolved into was a policy over whether or not someone who believed something fundamentally, such as the idea of creation, was allowed to teach that and to pass that on to the next generation. Sadly, Bishop Samuel Wilberforce, who was a really good orator and probably a great guy to be in this debate against Clarence Darrow, who is, of course, a very famous lawyer in his day, Bishop Samuel Wilberforce was not, unfortunately, very, very well educated in terms of the science of the time. He didn't press the issues that presented themselves in the theory of evolution enough. And for this reason, when the transcripts of the case came out, while he did win the case, he won the battle on whether or not this man who taught evolution should be fined. But he lost the war because he didn't have enough scientific evidence for what he believed. The problem with this is that as time has gone on, because of this trial and because of similar discoveries and ideas that came up in the early 1920s, our idea of science has shifted to the point that it is impossible for people to think of teaching the theory of creation once again. But the problem is, if we don't think of the theory of creation, okay, as another option, when we don't have enough evidence to prove one or the other, right? We don't, and they didn't back then, and I would contend that we don't really have the evidence to prove one or the other today, but we sweep one off the table because it's bad public policy, because it makes it sound like the government is biased towards religious ideas. You lose out on a fair and honest scientific debate. It becomes very biased. And that's what happened over time as this Scopes monkey trial came out and people realized that Bishop Samuel Wilberforce was really biased towards his religious belief rather than using scientific evidence to disprove Clarence Darrow. He lost the war on the public mind. And for this reason, the idea of creation was largely laughed upon. And to this, at this point, it can now probably be the opposite, that if you teach the theory of creation in schools today, you're very likely to be either booted, suspended, or ridiculed unless you're teaching at some type of Christian or fundamentalist school. So then it becomes a case where we have to look at the evidence. And if we're honest, and this is something that I learned when I was going through college, I was an environmental scientist, and I took a lot of biology courses, and I did a lot of research for astrophysics and other fields of science, shall I say. I realized that the idea of evolution is popular. It's popularly taught as fact, but in all honesty, the facts are much weaker than they would have you believe. And while it would be impossible, I believe, and maybe I'm wrong, maybe someone will come along and do it, but I don't think so. I think it's impossible to prove that creation or evolution is what's gonna happen, is what the truth is, because I don't think that science works on proof. Actually, I know it doesn't work on proof. This is actually one thing. Science does not work on proving things right. It works on proving things wrong. But for this reason, because we've really laughed one side of this debate out of the public sphere, we have missed a ton of evidence that the idea, the archaic theory of evolution that was taught in the 1800s, is almost patently ridiculous on its face as we look at it through a scientific lens today. There's a group that has done a lot of research from the creationist perspective, just to, you know, to get the bias out there, but a really good group of astrophysicists and scientists who have gone through and tried to analyze the creation evolution debate and try to explain where the holes in the evolution debate is and where the idea of creation, that God or an intelligent design was imposed on our universe, that there's a God or an intelligent being that makes our universe the way it is, might actually be scientific, even if it is incredible. They've gone through and they've done a lot of work, and they've done a lot of scientific analysis specifically on objects in our solar system that don't really jive with the idea of the theory of evolution. Because you have to remember that there's really two parts when you're talking about the idea of evolution. There's the way in which our universe evolves, like stars are created, stars form, stars die, solar systems are created, things that are on a much more macro level. And then there are things more on the micro level, like our DNA, which supposedly evolves over time in the theory of evolution. This group has gone through both, but I think particularly compelling is their work on the astrophysics and the solar system specifically. They talk about a lot of objects in our Earth, in our solar system, that don't really jive with the fact that they are 4.6 billion years old, which is a pretty accepted figure for the solar system. For instance, the rings of Saturn are one that they talk about. In 2017, the Cassini spacecraft crash landed onto Saturn. And at the same time, it deployed probes to Saturn's moons. And it went through the Saturn's rings and was an intentional crash land into the atmosphere of Saturn, which is, by the way, a gas giant. It doesn't really have an atmosphere per se. It is atmosphere. It is a gas ball. But the planet of Saturn is really amazing because it has the famous rings. And I'm sure you've all seen pictures of these rings online or in school. You know what they are. The fact is that these rings are incredibly thin, really thin. The way that this Answers in Genesis describes it is if you had San Francisco, right? If the rings were as wide across as San Francisco, they would be as thin as a sheet of paper. So they're so, so razor, razor thin. And the fact is that they are perfectly ordered, so perfectly ordered that each ring has a little slice in between it and the next ring. Each ring has been, at this point, numbered and identified by scientists, and there are even, within these rings, the Saturn's rings, there are patterns of swirling dust preserved over time. Now, the problem is, if you think about dust, right, because most of these things are rocks, ice, dust, that kind of junk that circles the planet. If you think about dust in a room, maybe you've walked into a room and you've seen dust that's lying on a table, or if there's a shaft of sunlight in a dark room, you see a little tiny bit of dust that's floating through the air. Just wave your hand through the air and you'll see that dust powder up and puff and disappear. The thing is that as soon as there's even the tiniest little bit of movement throughout a ring of dust or throughout anything that's very light like dust, it immediately mixes up. Similar to dropping a drop of food coloring in water, it will dissipate throughout water. Now, there's a slightly different process in water, but the principle is the same, that generally, like dust, it will spread out over time. The problem is these rings are perfectly preserved with braided patterns and spaces in between the rings and other things. And these rings are so thin that they haven't spread out upwards and downwards either. And the rings are believed to be about the same age as the planet itself, which scientists would say 4.6 billion years. The problem is, it's very strange And even scientists can't explain it very well. And this is evolutionary scientists can't explain it well. Why this dust should have been preserved in its perfect patterns for billions and billions of years. So, as an evolutionary scientist, they have to explain it away by the addition of hypothetical satellites or meteorites that have gone through and have swirled the dust into its specific patterns today. They have to make up all these hypothetical situations and then take them, if you will, on faith that they really happened. The same is true with our sun. Our sun, if it is what it's believed to be, which is the origin of the solar system, that over time things got thrown off of the sun and they became planets as they gravitationally pulled together. If that's true, they should all be spinning at about the same rate because they should be spinning and slowing down at the same rate as the sun. The problem is the planets are all spinning at different spin rates. And they're spinning at different spin rates that don't really make sense if they came off the sun. Because things will generally preserve momentum. It's the same idea as if you're driving a car and you suddenly take your foot off the gas pedal, your car will travel on at basically the same rate until it slows down to a stop. It won't suddenly speed up or suddenly slow down or start going backwards or a different direction. And that's kind of what we're seeing in the planets, that they're going such different directions. And so scientists continue to have these hypothetical situations where things collided with them or meteors flew out of outer space. And the problem is they're accepting all of these hypotheses, which may be very good hypotheses, but they're accepting them on faith, just like a Christian would do for the idea of creation. And the fact is it more credible that a never seen large object comes hurtling out of space and changes the orientation and the pattern of a whole solar system? That would mean it's pretty big because, you know, there's a lot of objects in our solar system. And there are so many of these cases, the spin of the Earth and the Moon together. We could take a whole day or whole month or whole year talking about these things, so I'm not going to go into them in a whole lot of detail. But there are tons of these little things that don't really jive, and so scientists have to make up a hypothetical which can't be proven in any way to explain their existence. Most compelling is if you look at the spin of the Earth, which is 23 degree tilt to the sun. It spins, of course, as we know, around its axis once per day, which is where we get our day and night. And it spins around the sun once per year. And it's just amazing because it is the perfect distance from the sun to support liquid water and to support an atmosphere like we have that has the concentration of nitrogen and oxygen that allows for life. And what's amazing is there's basically only one element that could possibly support life like the carbon-based life forms that we see on Earth. And our Earth is the only planet that we've ever found that has the perfect spin angle so that there's enough heat and enough cold so the heat is spread pretty evenly over a temporal zone where life forms can live. Where there's always going to be liquid water, but it's never going to get hot enough to destroy proteins that make up living beings. It's in the perfect place for life. And people can say, oh, but look, in other planets, life could evolve in a different way or with a different orientation so that they could adapt to the environment. The fact is, though, that carbon and its sister element, silicon, are very sensitive to temperature in the types of molecules which they will create. Carbon, if you heat it up too much in the presence of oxygen, will create carbon dioxide, right? Which is what we see when we start combustion engines or we start fires. That's what will happen with carbon. It will char. It'll turn to ash, basically. Water as well, which is essential for life because you have to have enough water to not only lubricate, but also to be able to transfer chemicals and transfer proteins. It's the basis of life. You have to have it in liquid form. if you have it in solid form, of course, things freeze and don't have any kind of mobility. If you have it in steam form, there's no way for it to stay inside of a body, right? It will immediately dissipate. And despite the fact that you can say that we are evolving to our environment, the fact is that our environment is perfectly suited to not only us today, but also to life in general. And it's so perfectly suited that there are thousands of these hypotheses that are made for the way in which life could be possible, for the way in which our Earth is slanted on that perfect 23-degree tilt so that the heat is spread perfectly. So that the reason that our Earth's atmosphere is around 4/5 nitrogen and 1/5 of oxygen. There are a couple other things, carbon dioxide and other elements in there, I know. But basically, it's a 5-to-1 ratio of nitrogen to oxygen. And it's because of this perfect ratio, this perfect tilt, a perfect thickness to our atmosphere to keep the warmth in, not let it out, that life is even possible. And the compounding of all of these very improbable scenarios together starts looking more and more like a mathematical impossibility. Couple that with the fact that our proteins in our body are all of one type of protein. Proteins can come in basically two orientations, and they're called left-handed and right-handed proteins. It's just the way in which they're denoted by scientists because of the way in which they form. Two different proteins, and all life forms on Earth are made with the left-handed proteins. So that means that 50% of the proteins that are possible, given the elements that we have in our atmosphere, could possibly sustain life. And each of our cells, even the most simple cells, like simple bacteria, have at least 300 individual and unique proteins that create them, that allow them to reproduce, that allow them to have the mechanisms to stay alive. Proteins are basically like little tiny molecular engines, if you will, that allow the body and cells to work. When you look at the fact that we have even the most simple cells, and I'm going to talk about only very, very simple cells, the very most simple cells, barely able to reproduce with basically only that built into them. Those simple cells have 150 proteins, let's say. And the fact that proteins have to be made from a perfect atmospheric condition to even be possible to be made. They have to come from a perfect atmospheric condition, which they call the hypothetical atmospheric soup that happened in the early days of our Earth, right? Billions and billions of years ago. But even in the perfect conditions, given the fact that millions of proteins would be made per day by lightning strikes striking this hypothetical atmospheric soup, which is, by the way, their legitimate theory of how life started, the chances of the proteins aligning in the perfect orientation to make up even the most simple of simple cells, and not only to be in the perfect orientation, but be able to work together, it is so mathematically improbable as to be ridiculously impossible. And people don't like to talk about it. This is something that has plagued evolutionary scientists for years and years and years on end, that they cannot explain how the basic ideas, because of the way our universe looks, that there are things that look very young, that our Earth is in a perfect orientation for life, and no other planet has ever been seen to be that way. And the fact that life, even the most simple life, is so complex that even in perfect conditions, it is basically a mathematical impossibility to even have the most, and remember, I'm talking about only the most simple, to even have the most simple life form evolve, has plagued the idea of evolution for years. And going back to the Scopes monkey trial, Bishop Samuel Wilberforce lost the war because he didn't talk enough about the science. And maybe he didn't know it because the science wasn't as advanced back in the 1920s as it is today. But to assume that because someone believes in God and believes that God created the earth is the most credible theory for how the earth was created, to ridicule that on scientific bases is ridiculous, because in any scientific theory known today, there are huge assumptions and mathematical impossibilities that must be overcome if they are to be correct. The only one, by the way, and I will talk about this next week on the podcast because I haven't gone into as much as I would like to, the only one that is even remotely credible, and yes, you'd have to assume the existence of God, but that's the only assumption you'd have to make, unlike the thousands and thousands of assumptions in the evolutionary theory of today. The only assumption you'd have to make is that there was a God who started life in the first place. And if you make that assumption, the idea is that the earth is younger and made by God in a perfect orientation makes a lot more sense scientifically. It jives a lot more with what we see in our universe today than even the theory of evolution does. And I'm going to explain next week some more cases in which the theory of evolution really, really breaks down, given evidence and given what we know today. And the fact is, it's archaic. And we don't want to be archaic. Anyway, I'm going to talk more about it next week. I am running out of time, so thank you so much for joining me. Back on 88.3, and of course, the podcast. Everywhere podcasts can be listened to, just say, "Hey Siri, play the podcast The Mother Lode Show," or go to Google Podcasts. You can go to Castbox, Spreaker, wherever you listen. And I'm Jackson Dunn.